This is Brittany Blackwell, host of the Resilient Teacher Podcast, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, along with this podcast. Each show on the network is independently owned, and the views expressed may not represent those of other podcasts. For the best education podcasts, visit edupodcastnetwork.com.
Hey, welcome back. Steve here, and today I'm talking with William J. Carl, a former pastor, seminary president, professor, Greek scholar, award-winning screenwriter, playwright, poet, and lyricist, and so much more. He's also the author of his first thriller. It's called Assassin's Manuscript. Oh, this is so cool. Action, twists, excitement, awesome story, awesome read, awesome conversation. You're going to love this book. You're going to love this talk. Thanks for listening. Oh, by the way, before you go, could you help out the podcast? I got a couple ideas for you if you'd like to try. You know, one of them is, how about telling a friend? You know, share the links. That would be cool. Another one would be, you know, you could go to my website and leave a review and subscribe. And or how about this? On the front of my website homepage is a link to buy me a coffee. And by clicking here, you could donate a dollar or two to help me address the costs associated with producing the podcast. What do you think? You're awesome. Enjoy the show.
So I began publishing, and I've been publishing nonfiction books. My goal with a nonfiction book is the same as with a fiction, and that is I want to grab you from the first line and keep you with me all the way through. However, it is a totally different medium to go from nonfiction to fiction.
It's the Education Podcast, your favorite show, with lots of groovy guests, and they share what they know. So crank it up to 10 and let your neighbors know that here's another show with Dr. Steve Mileto. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. Teaching, learning, leading K-12. With Dr. Steve Mileto.
Once a pastor, seminary president, professor, and U.S. Senate guest chaplain, William J. Carl, Ph.D., is a Greek scholar, award-winning screenwriter, playwright, poet, and lyricist. With the recent publication of Assassin's Manuscript, he is now the author of a thriller. He earned his Ph.D. from the University of Pittsburgh in Rhetoric and Communication. In 2013, he was given Pitt's Golden Medallion Award as a distinguished alumnus and was named one of 200 most influential leaders out of 300,000 living alums globally. Dr. Carl has spoken at dozens of leading schools, including Oxford, Cambridge, Princeton, Carnegie Mellon, Cornell, and Boston University. He has spoken in 40 states across the United States and in Russia, South Africa, India, Rwanda, Taiwan, Canada, South Korea, and China. He has lectured on the brain at medical conferences and medical schools since 2000. For 22 years, he appeared every third week on the ABC television affiliate in Dallas. He was also interviewed on the PBS affiliate in Dallas discussing the tensions between Christians, Muslims, and Jews in the Middle East, where his main theme was finding common ground. The author of 8 nonfiction books, 2 translated into Korean, and 75 articles and reviews for religious publications, his screenplay Maggie's Perfect Match was the winner of the Telluride Indie Fest screenwriting contest. He earned his bachelor's degree from the University of Tulsa, where in 1970 was named Man of the Year. He received his Master's of Divinity from Louisville Presbyterian Seminary, where he was the Patterson Fellow in Greek and named a distinguished alumnus in 2007. He received honorary doctorates from Presbyterian College, Sterling College, and Waynesburg College. Carl is presently the founder and CEO of LeConte Publishing, LLC, and partner and founding board member of Briggs Development Group. He is also the former president of Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. Born in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, he grew up in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. He has lived in Chicago, Tulsa, Louisville, Richmond, Dallas, Pittsburgh, and Birmingham. He resides in Maryville, Tennessee. A little bit about Assassin's Manuscript. When former CIA assassin Adam Hunter's last hit goes awry, he attempts to leave behind his world of espionage and murder by embarking on a career in ministry. But soon he is pulled back into crack a code hidden in an ancient manuscript in order to foil a terrorist plot. In the meantime, Rennie Ellis, a lawyer in the small town he's moved to, gets caught up in his dilemma and falls in love with him, not realizing he killed her fiancé by accident. What will she do when she finds out who Adam really is? The heist of a famous codex from the British Museum, papal intrigue in the Vatican, both Sicilian and Russian mafia, and a U.S. president who knows more than she admits all play key roles in a story that keeps the reader guessing until the end, a conclusion that no one sees coming. From Rome to Jerusalem, from Egypt's Mount Sinai to Tennessee's Smoky Mountains, the characters scramble for their lives, Racing the Clock to Prevent an International Disaster. Our focus today is William's novel, Assassin's Manuscript. William, thanks so much for being on the show, and say hi to everyone.
Well, hi. It's great to be with you here, Stephen, and I'm glad to talk about the novel today. It's going to be fun.
That it is, and it's really cool, and I love this type of book, and you've written a doozy here, so this is cool. Our focus today is your book, Assassin's Manuscript. You've received awesome reviews, and here are a few excerpts from readers on Goodreads. Someone said, fast-paced thriller that will keep you guessing to the very end, and another one said, fast-moving with more twists and turns than the switchbacks in the Smoky Mountains that provide one of the locations. This book takes you to different continents and locations at a dizzying speed. And finally, a true wordsmith, Carl's use of descriptive similes and metaphors and rich vocabulary paint vivid pictures that invite the reader in. So what inspired you to write a thriller?
Alex Haley, the author of Roots. I had him as a guest to speak at a program we called Town Hall Forum in Dallas, Texas. And he was sitting in my office and he said, have you written anything? And I said, yeah. He said, well, let me see something you've written. So I pulled a book off the shelf, which was a set of lectures I'd given at Princeton. And here he is sitting on my couch, thumbing, and this is the author of Roots, thumbing and reading my book. And he looks at me and he says, Bill, you need to write a novel. I said, Alex, what makes you say that? He said, two things. One, you know how to write, and you write really well. This is the author of Roots telling me I write really well. And then he said, and you know how to tell a story, and that's all a novel is. And I said, what kind of novel would I write? And he said, what do you like? Oh, I like Tom Clancy, you know, Jack Ryan, the Jason Bourne and Robert Ludlum, all the international espionage. Daniel Silva was just getting started way back then, so I hadn't read as much of him, but I like those now a lot. And he said, write one like that. I said, Alex, I don't know anything about that. That is not my world. And he said, well, you're a Greek scholar. You know old manuscripts. Why don't you put those two worlds together? And so 30 years later, Assassin's Manuscript is a Dan Brown meets Daniel Silva thriller. So that's how I got into it.
I love that. That's awesome. And to think that he's sitting there in your office and giving you comments, I think that's pretty cool.
It's interesting, Stephen, because people will say to you or others, hey, you ought to write a book. You know, people will say that to people. You ought to write a book. And you kind of go, okay, whatever. But Alex Haley says you should write a book. You have to pay attention to that, you know.
You got that right. Just a little pressure there. There is pressure there.
There were many times that I gave up across 30 years, and I'll talk a little more about that in terms of the rewriting. But, you know, you never give up. Anybody who is listening to your show today who's a writer or trying to be a writer, a wannabe, and you go and you go and then you helps get some help and this and that, but you kind of quit. Don't quit. Stay with it. Go again. Never give up. That's what happened to me.
I love that. That is awesome. That is cool. Well, glad that he encouraged you to write, and we're talking about it today, and it's awesome. So, all right. So you've written many nonfiction works. This is cool because, you know, a bunch of nonfiction works. What was it like to write a thriller? I mean, was it difficult?
It was very hard. My first nonfiction book was 1979 because I was at a theological school on the faculty and it's publish or perish, right? You walk into the bookstore and you see all your colleagues' names over all the books. No one had said publish or perish. They just put the pressure on you and you had to write. So I began publishing, and I've been publishing nonfiction books. My goal with a nonfiction book is the same as with a fiction, and that is I want to grab you from the first line and keep you with me all the way through. However, it is a totally different medium to go from nonfiction to fiction. In fiction, it's about plot. It's about characters. It's about keeping the story moving. And my first My first version of Assassin's Manuscript was 740 pages. It was like, wow, War and Peace, you know. I threw everything in the kitchen sink in there. And I took it into a literary agent in Texas, and I dropped it on his desk. He said, you nearly broke my desk with that thing. Go take 200 pages out of it, and then I'll look at it. Now, you know, That's like killing your own babies. I mean, what are you going to, how are you going to take 200 pages? Someone suggested learn how to write screenplays, which I did. And I really got pretty good at it to the point I won the Telluride IndieFest screenwriting contest with a totally different type of a romantic story, a romantic comedy. And I've got a manager in LA and trying to help me shop that and whatever. It's called Maggie's Perfect Batch. And if anybody's listening that wants to do something with that, let me know. But the point is, I learned how to tighten the story. Dialogue in screenplays is very tight. And my dialogue was too long in the first version of this. So I had to learn a lot. And I'll mention a little bit more about characters in one of your upcoming questions. But it was a totally different kind of writing for me. It was not easy. And that's why it took me 30 years to get it finished.
It's neat, though, that you took that direction to help figure out how to tighten it up, shorten it up, make it more concise by writing screenplays.
Let me give you an example. And you've read the book, so you'll remember this scene. There's a scene where the Bedouin, who is, you know, the terrorist, is in St. Catherine's Monastery in a cell, and he's gotten an old monk to create what looks like a very old manuscript. And he's going to get on the phone and tell Conrad Dougherty, who is the rogue CIA character, that, you know, I've got the manuscript. But in my earlier version of this in the novel, I have the Bedouin get on the phone and say, okay, I've got the manuscript. The monk has now been killed. You'll need to get it delivered to Adam Hunter so he can take it to the Vatican and get it translated and yada, yada. He says a whole bunch of stuff. And somebody coaching me said, no, he wouldn't say any of that. He would simply say, it's done. That's all he would say. So I had lots of examples of that, of how to tighten the dialogue, because the reader can see everything that's happened. The Bedouin doesn't have to repeat what everybody sees. In a movie, they've seen what's happened. So sure enough, it's done.
I like that. That's cool. That's neat to know how you went from all this stuff to that. Nice. All right, your story takes place throughout the world. Did you actually travel to other countries to help you with these settings? I mean, or had you been there already?
I did. I traveled to all of them, and my wife went to some of them with me, and I went by myself to others. Sometimes I was speaking. I was with a group in Israel, and then I, on my own, hired a Bedouin driver and an Egyptian guide to take me to St. Catherine's Monastery, which is where my main character goes at the foot of Mount Sinai in Egypt. And I've spoken in Russia and Moscow and up in the Ural Mountains, and I've been to London many times and Toronto and Washington, D.C. And Rome, and all these places are in the novel. And I would take notes to describe them. And so all the reviewers are saying, hey, we can tell that he's been to all these places because the description is so exquisite. I will tell you, Stephen, that the only place that I haven't been to that's in the novel is the papal apartment. And that's because I didn't know the Pope. And so I did know a scholar in New York who knew the Pope very well, had been in the papal apartment. And I knew a bishop of an archdiocese in Texas, and I got them to tell me exactly how to describe it. And I want to mention one other thing about the Pope, and that is when I first wrote this, which was 30 years ago, I was describing a fictional Pope. It wasn't like John Paul II at the time. But if you've read the book, you can see for yourself. If you look closely, that Pope in the novel is almost exactly like Pope Francis today. And that is amazing to me that it turned out that way.
Nice.
Because I didn't intend it. I didn't change a word of the Pope from way back, you know. But I did go to all the countries. I went to all the places, yep.
That's so cool. It really is. And I got to say, it's interesting how 30 years later, you're seeing, wow, was I connected into a special signal
whatever.
There or what?
Whatever. Yeah. It's just amazing coincidence is what it is.
It's awesome. All right, so let's talk about a few writing techniques. I mean, this is your first novel. Did you outline or just start writing and go where your characters took you?
I would say I did both. And I mean, when I lecture, I know you have some professors and teachers who are probably listening to this, and they have to put together lectures and presentations to classes and maybe public lectures. I always outline. I think it's important to outline. But I think I learned in my fiction writing that you don't want to outline too tightly. And it's really more about characters than it is about plot. If it's too much about plot, people won't want to read it. You know, you've got to write characters that people will care about. Otherwise, why read this story? I don't know. And so I worked hard on creating interesting characters. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But I think it's important to have short chapters. I believe in that. I'm easily bored when I read a book, really easily bored. I want you to grab me from the first line, and I want you to stay with me. Why? My wife and I read at night, and I'm lying there in bed, and, you know, I'm looking at how long is this chapter? You know, can I put a bookmark at the end of this chapter? And so I myself needed to write short chapters, and I wrote them with hooks at the end of each one. So it keeps you going, fast paced. I mean, you seem to have had that experience when you read it, Stephen. And I also believed that it was important to have chapter titles as opposed to 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 77, which is boring. So I created chapter titles that were fun. I wanted them to be enticing, exciting, but also not tell too much and yet tell a little. And if you notice that I have 6 sections to the book, and they all start with the letters P-R-E. So each one kind of describes Adam going to a different part of the world. So premise, predicate, predicament, pretenders, premonition, and predator and prey. All six start with these first 3 letters, P-R-E. And so that was important in organizing the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, I love it when the author has some rhyme or reason to why they're titled, or there's some scheme that they're following or something like that. Because, yeah, I get bored with numbers. And I think what's awesome to hear you say is I do the same sort of thing. I look for, okay, can we not like end the chapter a little sooner? Because it would be really nice to look forward to that coming up, as opposed to this is going to take a while. And I hear you. I'm someone who, you know, it can, and I read a lot. I read a lot of books, and I really like a good thriller, something that makes me, okay, I got to stay up because I got to know what happens next. And then the next thing you know is that, that 15 more minutes has turned into a couple hours.
One more comment that I want to make about the writing and the organization. You will notice, because you've read it, that there are a lot of characters. And I put a list of characters at the end of the story so that people can go, wait a minute, where are we? Because this happens all over the world, like a Clancy or a Ludlum story. But if you watch carefully, and I see if you notice this also, Stephen, that at the first you're wondering, wait a minute, how do all these characters relate to each other? And I realized this was like having a big quilt, but I'm only working on the outside pieces first. And as the novel progresses, those outside pieces begin to come together, like the robbery of the Codex from the British Museum, which is life imitating art, because if you noticed last summer, The Economist, The Guardian, all kinds of Wall Street Journal, New York Times had big stories about robberies of famous artifacts from the British Museum. And nice. That's like at the beginning of my book is the robbery of the famous Codex. But that's not the manuscript Adam Hunter, my main character, is dealing with. He's dealing with the manuscript that the Bedouin had the monk create. And yet we have these two manuscripts. How are they going to relate? And if you keep reading, you'll see how they connect and finally come together. That was hard pulling that off, I will say.
I can imagine. That's awesome. I think it's always neat when an author can make a lot of things come together that you think are not really that connected.
Right.
As the story goes on, you start going, oh, wait a second. All right. I'm starting to see where this is, you know, that they are connected and how that might work out there. So I think that's awesome. One of the things that you just talked about a second ago is you're talking about characters. Speaking of characters, let's talk about that now. I mean, could you talk about how a minister turned novelist writes about an assassin turned minister turned assassin?
Yeah, that is odd, isn't it? However, I will say, because I told Alex Haley at the very beginning, I love these kind of stories, it was easy for me to lean into that. I mean, I like movies like this, you know, or like novels like this. And so it's sort of funny because other interviewers will say, wait a minute, this is about a former CIA assassin who becomes a minister in Maryville, Tennessee, which is, of course, where I live right now. And they all ask me, wait a minute, is this autobiographical? And I pause and smile and say, well, you know, all writing is autobiographical. Nice. And let it just sort of hang there in the air, you know. And then I go on and add that when I was in theological school, we had an extracurricular course, which included 3 full years of Taekwondo karate to handle rough parishioners, you know. So, I mean, obviously I've never used it on anybody, but, you know. So I know how to describe the action scenes in my novel because I had all that training. But no, I never worked for the CIA, and no, I never actually have ever actually killed anybody. However, I love this kind of story. And I think when you're an author, whether it's nonfiction or fiction, you need to love what you're working on. You need to be passionate about. Again, I've been a professor. I know some of your listeners are professors. And one of the great senses of finding a really good professor is she or he passionate about what she is teaching or what she is lecturing or what she is writing? And that comes through in the story. So for me, this was fun.
That's cool.
That's a short answer to your question.
Oh, it works. It works. I like the... Oh, all kinds of stuff happening right there when you talk about that type of transition with a character. So I love it. All right. So I've heard you describe your story as not having good guys and bad guys. Could you share what the reader will discover about your characters?
Right. So many of the Tom Clancy type stories have good guys and bad guys, right? I mean, and the Americans are all good guys and the whoever, Arabs or whoever, are bad guys, right? Well, I didn't want that. I wanted all my characters to be broken and flawed because I think that's more realistic. I think it's more nuanced when you read multi-level characters like that. And for me, this has got some literary depth because I used Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces and Christopher Vogler's The Writer's Journey. Adam Hunter is the name of the main character. So Adam in Hebrew means humankind. Hunter means he's in search of something. So Adam represents a violent humanity out of control in search of peace. Nice. Right? And boy, we can see that today in Ukraine and Israel, Gaza. We are a violent humanity out of control, right? So Adam represents who we are today. Rennie, which is the main female character, has a name that is a nickname for Irene, which in Greek means peace. And she's the only one who can complete his mythic story. The question the reader has is, will she? Because he killed her fiance by accident in an opening scene that happens before the novel starts and is handled in flashbacks. And the question is, as she begins to fall in love with him, will she ever find out that he killed her fiance? And if she does, what's she going to do? So there's this literary depth going on, and there are many others, like Anastasia Palaiologos, the old Greek woman who wants to get the Codex Sinaiticus back to St. Catherine's in Egypt. Her name in Greek, Anastasia Palaiologos, means resurrection of the old word. I never say that. Even the Russian characters, Their names mean something. So it's kind of fun for a reader to kind of go deeper and say, wait a minute, this isn't just a typical beach read, even though it is fast-paced and fun. There's some literary depth to this story, and I want to uncover the nuggets that are hidden there.
I love that, especially to know that you did all that work to align the names, and they could figure that out or not figure that out. And it just, what a neat way of coming up with the names for your characters. I like that. You know, one of the things that I got to mention here is that Assassin's Manuscript is available as a paperback, ebook, and as an audiobook. Your audiobook is read by David Carl, and I would think that the listeners would recognize that that is the same last name as yours, and David is your son. What is that like to have your son read your words and story?
Oh, it was a riot. I want to mention, because at the first part of this question, you said it's available paperback ebook. The ebook is now on sale in 42 countries around the world.
Wow.
On Kobo and other places, Rakuten Kobo. And it's on sale in the Harvard bookstore, the actual paperback, which is kind of surprised me to see that popping up. But David is a very successful, trained actor living in Brooklyn. He's been on movies like he's in the George Clooney's movie, The Tender Bar, in a wonderful scene with Ben Affleck. He's been on Blue Bloods. He does improv shows. He's got one called Gary Busey's One Man Hamlet, which won big New York Times reviews, positive, and he's won all kinds of awards with that and done in Edinburgh. Another one called Trump Lear. Imagine Trump and King Lear together in one show as nice. A one-man show. And he's in the final season of The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel that was last summer. He has a key character. He's kind of a fun character. So I was thinking, I think I need to put this in audiobook. I'd already published it, and it was out there for a good while, several months. And I had a lot of friends who said, I don't read books, I listen to them. Stephen, you may know people like that who say, yes. I don't read books. Yeah. And they're jogging, or they're driving to and from work, or they're at the fitness center, or whatever it is. So I began exploring what's involved in that. And they said, well, you've got to find a narrator, and you're going to have to, you're going to have to interview people and this and that. And I go, well, David, our son, has done narration for James Patterson's novels. So I don't need to go find somebody else. Why not? I didn't know if he'd agree to go with it with me or not, but he did. He thought it sounded fun. And Stephen, we just had a riot. I mean, and it may be the only father-son author-narrator collaboration in the country right now. Can you think of one?
No, I can't. I think that's so cool.
Parent-child, you know, kind of collaboration. So we had so much fun working on that thing.
And so also when I was reading this about it, I was looking at Audible, and I was reading a little bit about your book as an audio book, because from time to time I listen to books. I'm someone who I just like holding paper. Right? There's something about holding a paper book and turning the pages and stuff. But right. I still, you know, will listen from time to time to an audio book. And so I was going over there and I was reading what it said, and I went. After I listened to the sample, I went, it's read by somebody with the last name Carl. and then I saw a reference somewhere where he was your son. I thought, that's really cool. That is, what a neat thing.
And he's an expert on international accents. So in the robbery of the Codex Sinaiticus from the British Museum, which is about the fourth chapter, I think, you will hear David do five different British accents in one chapter. He is so amazing. And the Russian accents, the Italian, he knows Italian. And it's just, and he does New Orleans Cajun and East Tennessee.
Nice.
I mean, he does all these accents. And he distinguishes between male and female voice. Just for the experience, people should get David reading Audible version of Assassin's Manuscript. It's a riot.
It is an awesome performance, and it's really cool. Just the words themselves, the way he pronounces the different words of the different places and such, it just comes off sweet. I love it.
It is great.
Kudos. All right, so I understand that you interviewed real-life assassins for your book. What'd you learn from them?
Well, people wonder, how in the world did you meet real life?
Yeah, I was wondering that too.
First of all, and you know, I'm an extrovert. And so I walk into restaurants and walk around to booths and tables.
Nice.
And I ask people, do you like what you're eating? And they look up at me like, yeah, I guess it's okay. You know, and my family backs away, you know, we shouldn't take him out in public. You know, we don't know him, but I just liked meeting people. And so I met all these, and they're all males, all these guys. One was a taxi driver in Louisville, Kentucky. I was coming in for a board meeting late one night. He was the last pickup. He was picked me up at midnight, took me to the Brown Hotel downtown. So I started asking him about it. I loved it. Do you ever talk to taxi or Uber or Lyft drivers? Just get to know them. You know, it's kind of fun. And so I could tell he wasn't from Louisville, Kentucky, because he said things like cup of coffee, you know, and he was definitely New York. And so I said, so you're from New York? Yeah. Well, when'd you get here? I came here after Nam. And I said, oh, what'd you do in Vietnam? I was in the Phoenix Project. And I go, oh, well, I knew that was assassins. So I said, you got to pick anybody else up tonight? And he said, no. And I said, well, if I cross your palm with a $100 bill, can we have a drink and you can tell me stories? Hell yeah, I'd love to do that. So this guy opened up and told me all these stories about what it was like to be an assassin. And then another one, it's hard to believe, but this other one, another American, is a librarian at a seminary in the United States. I'm not going to name the guy or the seminary, but he was on an accreditation site visit team that I was chairing up in D.C., and we were having dinner, and he said, what are you working on? I told him, and he said, oh, that's what I used to do. I said, what? You got to be kidding. This guy's a librarian. He's a trained theologian now, you know, like my main character, right? Nice. So he said, yeah, there are countries I can't even go to now. The third American, there were three Americans. The third one was the son of an assassin. And I was lecturing at a college. My wife says, don't name the college. Okay. So I was lecturing. And at the end, in the Q&A, they said, what are you working on? I told them, because they knew about the other books I'd written. And they said, oh, you're working on an international espionage about an assassin. So this guy comes up to me. He's a young guy, Stephen. And he's a philosophy professor. He said, can we go have a drink? I said, sure. So we went. And he said, my dad was a hitman for the CIA. And he told me on his deathbed. He confessed to me on his deathbed.
Wow.
That's what he used to do when he traveled around the world. He said, you would never believe it. He was a regular little league dad in the neighborhood. And then the Israeli was running a tennis tournament in Texas. And our older son, who's now teaching tennis pro in D.C. and was captain of his varsity college team, was playing. He was a teenager. And I got to talking with this Israeli, and I could tell. He said, I'm from Israel. And I said, yeah, I can tell. And I said, when'd you come here? He told me. I said, now everybody in Israel has to serve in the military. He said, yeah. I said, which part? He said, Mossad. I said, oh, what part of Mossad? He said, the Kidan unit. Well, I knew that the Kidan unit was assassins because of all the research. And I said, can you tell me some stories? Yeah, I'll be glad to. And I stood there and took notes while I was watching my son play tennis out in this tournament. And he told me that he had Arafat in his sights twice, but the order to take the shot never came. And the Russian is a pastor in the Ural Mountains who is a former mafia chief who had killed a lot of people. Then he decided he wanted to become a minister. So he's like my main character, Adam Hunter. I needed to get inside this character to be able to describe him. And you've read the book, so you know there's a scene in Rome where Rennie just starts pushing. She knows there's something. She's fallen in love with this guy, but she knows there's something more about him. And he just can't bring himself to say what actually happened in New York. But she gets him to talk about what is it like to kill somebody. And he starts opening up, and then something happens that interrupts them. You remember that. But anyway, I needed this information. And the biggest surprise to me, Stephen, was how normal these people were. Totally normal. Could be like your next door neighbor. Or if you remember the movie Carlos the Jackal, where Bruce Willis is Carlos the Jackal, And he's gotten close to somebody who's going to get him close to, I guess he's going to try to kill the vice president or something. And he's in this guy's apartment. The guy's jabbering away. He's got everything he needs. He's eating Chinese food, watching TV. And the guy just keeps jabbering. So he picks up a silencer and he goes thump, thump, shoots him, goes back to eating Chinese food. Now that's a real assassin.
Yes.
Cold as ice.
Jeez.
Just that's it. Or you're having a cup of coffee. Wait a minute. I'll be back in a few minutes. They go out and kill somebody. They come back here. I need some more coffee. You know, they're just totally normal otherwise.
Yeah, that is a different lifestyle right there.
But I had to meet them to be able to write one. And one of the other interviews I did with a podcast interviewer in UK titles the interview, How to Write Like a Killer. That's the title of the interview with me, because I had to learn how to do that.
That's so awesome. That's, I can imagine. And, you know, and walk away from it too, I would think. It can't be a one-time conversation.
No, that's right. It was just really fun getting to know these guys. And it's so fascinating because I didn't sense a lot of remorse for things they had done. They just, that was their life, and now they have a different life. It's really amazing.
That is something else. That's wild. one of the things I love about your writing is that your language is very descriptive, and I love that. And I'll give you some examples. So, on page 87, the tall, barrel-chested Brit felt out of place in a suit, but he always wore one well. I love this because for anyone who's seen someone who just it might look all right on them, but you can just tell they're just itching to just rip the thing off and get on with whatever, the jeans or something else. And I love that. And you feel that.
That's Ian McPherson, the Scotsman who's a former British SAS. And he's a great character. He's the bodyguard for Anastasia Palaiologos. Yeah.
I love that. And it's especially having family members who describe past family member as this barrel-chested man. And so I have this image of height and the size of somebody, and it just really works. I like that. You know, on page 197, here's another example. Then it started to rain, first a drop, then a pitter, then a patter, a mist, a drizzle. The soft soaker turned to a steady shower. Then came the cloudburst, the downpour. Man, this is cool. Talk about, it's neat because it's just what you need. You don't need a whole bunch of other stuff. Because if anybody's ever experienced rain, you know, especially one that eventually becomes a downpour, it really happens like that. And especially usually you're like out somewhere in the backyard trying to get to the front, and you're too late.
Right.
So do you practice this way of storytelling? I mean, do you work on writing descriptions? I mean, or is this just something that you do?
I think it's a combination. I mean, I've spoken in 40 states around the United States and a dozen foreign countries and a lot of interesting academic places. I think it's important to write well, whatever you're doing, whether you're speaking or you're writing an article or, you know, I've got 75 peer-reviewed articles and lots of reviews. I like describing things. I think it's fun. And in fact, look, if you've got a minute, let me just read part of one of the chapters. Actually, this is the beginning of the free sample that my son does, but just a couple little paragraphs.
Cool.
Adam had carried on a lover's quarrel with Rome all his life. You know, I had fun writing that sentence.
Nice.
You know, although his Italian was a little rusty, he had no trouble making his way to the Borghese Gardens overlooking Piazza del Popolo, where he was to meet his contact. Rome seemed to Adam like one large inhabited work of art. In the distance, St. Peter's rose majestically above the Tiber. Next to San Pietro, he could see the top of Tosca's Castel d'Angelo. Large stone lions guarded the Egyptian obelisk in the piazza below him, where artists and lovers gathered, and gypsy children targeted unsuspecting tourists. And it goes on from there. I mean, I just had fun. I have fun when I write, you know, and I maybe write too much. And that's why, you know, I'm a professor. So sometimes people will say, what time is it? And I tell them how to make a watch. You know, that's what professors do. We say too much. So that's when I had to learn how to tighten, how to revise, And as I mentioned earlier, there were 12 revisions to this novel. My editor was Charles Cornwell, former professor of English at Davidson College in North Carolina, and former husband of Patricia Cornwell, the novelist, and her editor through all her novels.
Cool.
He was my editor through all 12 revisions. And on the last one, on the 12th one, he said, it's masterful, Bill. Get it out there. It's time to go. Go for it. I will tell you one funny story about at the very end of the process. He said, I originally had the big explosion where he kills his own wife by accident and he kills the fiance of Rennie Ellis and he kills the Bedouin's girlfriend. I had that as an opening scene. And he said, get that out of there. You know, I said, Charles, I worked hard on that. And he said, I don't care. Get it out of there and start with the Bedouin looking down on the infidel Americans in Cairo. That's a much crisper way to start your novel. And I said, what am I going to do with that opening scene? He says, handle it in flashbacks. And I go, oh, man, that's going to take so much work. And he said, I'm telling you, you need to do that. Well, I asked another author friend of mine about this who sold a bunch of novels. And I said, what do you think I should do? And he said, I want you to listen to me very carefully, William. If an editor who'd helped another author sell $100 million worth of books told me to do something, I might actually do it. And I go, okay, you're right. So I pulled that out and you can see, cause you read it, it's in flashbacks. And everybody I've mentioned that to, oh yeah, that's a lot better to do it that way. Well, you need a really good editor, right? I like to say that great books, great stories, screenplays, plays, novels, poems are not written, they're rewritten, right? And so Stephen King, who's obviously a very successful author, I don't read much of his books because of all the horror stuff, but he's a very good writer, obviously, very successful. He has a book called On Writing, and it's wonderful. I recommend to anybody who's working on writing novels. And he has a great line that I'll never forget. It goes like this: to write is human, to edit is divine. Isn't that a great line?
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. And so here I was rewriting. I like to think of the way I worked on this novel is it's like Michelangelo working on I don't want to compare myself to Michelangelo, but any author working on a slab of stone. And he keeps chipping away, knowing that there is a David hidden there. And eventually the David emerges. That's what good revising does. It brings the David out. It brings what you're trying to get. So here I do. I revise this thing 12 times before I actually publish it. But, you know, Charles Frazier rewrote Cold Mountain 20 times. So who's counting, you know?
Wow. Yeah, there you go. There you go. I like that. When someone who's helped somebody else sell that many books tells you something, yeah, you probably should do it. That's
pay attention to it.
Good. In that Stephen King book, one of the things I like is in the back he tells a story of when he was injured by a passerby in a van, and he tells the story of it happening, and he makes the realization. He goes, "It dawned on me. I'd just been run over by one of my characters," and. And it's such a funny line because of how crazy the situation was, and it's cool to know that you've also read other books like that and so forth, trying to put things together. I love that.
Let me mention one thing.
Okay,
you triggered a thought in my mind about the characters. I believe when you really work hard on a novel, you get to know the characters so well that they talk to you. They say things like, no, that's not the way I would say that. Or they tell you, no, this is not what I would do. Here's what I would do. And that actually happened to me. It's like I was hearing voices.
Love it.
But when you do that, it makes it a better story. So I love the fact that the characters talk to you.
That's so cool. I love that. Love it. All right. So what's next? I mean, will your story continue? Anything in the works?
You know, I have a really wild and crazy idea for a sequel. But I haven't gotten inspired to just sit down and do it. And there's another way in which, because the novel ends in Jerusalem with a global vision of peace, which is kind of amazing given what's actually going on there. So if I wrote a sequel related to any of that, I've got to wait years to see what's actually going to happen. So I may or may not do anything with that. Because I lecture on the brain at medical schools and medical conferences, I have a nonfiction book in mind on neuroscience and being the best version of you you can be. And that's another direction. I also have a neuroscience idea that would be either a play or a movie. So it's just going to take some time to think it through. This may be a one-off. Who knows? I don't know.
Well, if it is, it's a good one. And I noticed where a couple of your reviewers ask the question, where are we going next?
Well, one of them said, we want to know what he's going to write with characters he didn't kill off in the new in the first novel.
Yes, I like that.
Anyway,
good stuff. I love it. All right, William, if someone we're finishing up now, if someone wanted to follow up with you or connect with you or learn more, where would you send them?
Well, I have an email address, which is just a Gmail, 311 Bill C, 311 Bill C at gmail.com. And, you know, people could write me there or go to my website, which is LeContePublishing.com, and learn more about me there. I have a place where they can contact me there too, but the quickest way to get to me is 311BillC@gmail.com.
Very cool. I'll put that information in my show notes so they can reach out to you and ask you a question. So I got two last questions I like to ask my guests. One of them goes like this: how'd you complete your novel? I mean, many have ideas about what to write, but their novel is never finished. And I know you took 30 years for yours. What advice do you have for new writers trying to finish?
Yeah. So if you're a J on the Myers-Briggs, which means decisive, organized, finish things, you're not going to have quite as much trouble. If you're a P on the Myers-Briggs, which means you just want to keep talking in a committee, going on forever. I've known speakers who have to get up and speak, and they were continuing to edit their talks as they got into the podium. If they hadn't had to give the talk, they would have spent the rest of their life rewriting. At some point, you have to stop. But for me, it's about the outlining part, which is I always write with the end in mind. I have the end figured out, and then I write to that place. If you want to just think in terms of the theological or biblical ideas, the Passion narratives, Cross and Resurrection, were written first. Then where'd this guy go? What'd he do? And at the end, they thought, well, let's figure out where he came from. And Mark doesn't even have anything about infancy narrative. So you want to think writing backwards. You're leading to something. And so I think it's important pretty early on to have your end in mind, and then you write to it. But I also think it's important to say it's time to stop. And when it's time to stop, it's time to stop. I've heard speakers who are like, you know, they're putting their landing gear down, but they never quite land. You know, they keep circling and coming around. Come on, when you put the landing gear down, boom. And when I got to the end of this, I knew that's it. I don't want to write another word. It ends here. So that's the advice I would give.
Awesome advice. Love it. Love it. Last question for you goes like this: do you have a teacher in your past who made a difference in your life? If so, who was it? And what would you say if given the chance to say thank you?
Oh, I've got too many to name, but I'll just focus on one which is related to my writing as much as anything, and that's Theodore Wendt, W-I-N-D-T. Ted Wendt was a professor of mine at Pitt when I was doing my PhD in rhetoric and communication. You know, a lot of Ivy League schools don't have graduate programs in rhetoric. So two of the top programs are Pitt and Northwestern. So there I was at one of the top programs. Classical rhetoric, rhetoric of the radical movements, the rhetoric of the sciences and the social sciences. And Ted Wendt was a world-class authority on presidential rhetoric. And unfortunately, he's deceased now, but I'm telling you, he would have a field day with presidential rhetoric right now with just the two candidates that we have. And he was brilliant. And I'll never forget walking into that class on rhetorical criticism, which was required class for all of us in the graduate school. And he greeted us with, you will write four 25-page papers in this class. An A paper is a publishable paper. When I say publishable, I don't mean the usual drivel you read in most journals. I want you to write like Walter Lippmann. I want your sentences to crackle. And by the way, most graduate school classes, the professors only give A's and B's. I give C's, D's, and F's. Anything late is an F. Any questions? That's how he started the class.
Nice, nice.
And another woman in the class and I got a B on our first paper, and everybody else got C's, D's, and F's because he took the blue pencil to the thing. And he really, I mean, I finally ended up with an A in the class, and I knew I'm going to write my dissertation under this guy because it will be good if I do it under him. And he taught me how to write. So I would love to say to Ted, look what you produced in me, this amazing novel, Assassin's Manuscript. And I want to thank you for all you taught me about how to be a good writer.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing. William, thank you so much for sharing your book, Assassin's Manuscript. Love it. Page Turner, exciting. I love this stuff. Wishing you the best in all you do.
Thank you. Great to be with you today, Stephen.
Hey, you have been listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12, a podcast to help you help kids achieve their dreams. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the Education Podcast Network, podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a member of the podcast network based in Canada called Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right. The opinions expressed on Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Hey, thanks for listening. It would be awesome if you visited my website at stephenmileto.com and connected with me, left a review, and listened to more episodes. And by the way, you could also share it with your friends, with your family, and your colleagues. Thanks so much. You're awesome.